Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. It's your boy Letlhakonolo, and I'm so excited to just get to live out some of my wildest dreams and be in conversations with authors about some of the books I love. And I get to do it with one of my favorite people, Dr. Slay.
Hi everyone, I'm so excited to be discussing today's book with our amazing author. I'm so in love with this book. Letlhakonolo knows that I read this book in one sitting. That's how much I absolutely enjoyed it. And I have the pleasure of introducing today's guest, who is Peace Adzomedi, a Ghanaian writer and senior lecturer in gender and international politics at the University of Bristol. She previously authored Global Norms and Local Action, The Campaigns to End Violence Against Women in Africa. And she holds a PhD in Public and International Affairs from the University of Pittsburgh and a BA in Geography from the University of Ghana. She was born in Liberia, and His Only Wife is her debut novel. Welcome to the Cheeky Natives, Peace.
Thank you for having me. I am excited to be joining you both today.
Peace, I have one. The first initial question is that you're an author of an academic book, and His Only Wife is a debut novel. How was the move from writing academically to writing fiction?
Fiction writing actually came before academic writing. I started writing many, many years ago, and just because I ran out of books. And so I would write my own stories and write my own novellas and then read them and pretend like they've been written by someone else. So it's something that I'm very much used to doing. But when I was writing His Only Wife, I think I was very careful that I didn't want to sound like an academic. Because in reality, a lot of what I cover in the book, a lot of the themes are themes that come out of my own research and come out of my scholarship. And I wanted to kind of communicate this to a wider audience without sounding like an academic, without making people feel like they were reading a textbook or a cultural studies book. So that was kind of the fine line that I was walking in wanting to discuss these very relevant issues concerning women and gender and class, but at the same time, to not sound like I do in my academic writing. And so it was just, as I was writing, I was constantly reminding myself about this, and constantly, I guess, editing myself as I wrote.
I think it's interesting that you've said that piece, because I think that you covered a lot of the themes of your academic work in the writing. And so for me, I want to know the ways in which you think that your personal politics influenced the ways in which you wrote the characters. So how you chose to write in Evelyn, for example, how did your personal politics influence that kind of character development?
Yeah, I think I will admit that I think some of the characters really are, and yeah, this is where my personal politics come in, and Evelyn is a good example. It's kind of what I would love to see more of, and certain traits and behaviors that I would like to see embraced in society. And so I did write people and attitudes and behaviors that I think are very important, especially when it comes to women's place in society and how women are able to negotiate and kind of make space for themselves. And I've said before, so Evelyn, the character in the book is she's I've described her as disrespectful, but and I do think that there's need for more disrespectful women. And so I think that is one way in which my personal politics, I guess, shines through and kind of shape the characters that I wrote.
I think it's really interesting that you say that piece. I'm also wondering a lot about like how your own positionality in the world sort of plays in the politics of this book, right? So you were born in Liberia, and we know that there's a character, Muna, in the book who's also from Liberia, and you studied in Ghana, and the book is placed in Ghana. So I sort of want to know about the geopolitics of the book, right? Like literally the positionality. Was it important for you to weave these two geographical locations in the writing as sort of a way to think through your own politics and positionality?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, the characters and the stories is fictional, but at the same time, there's a lot that's, I guess, personal in the book. So the Afi starts off in Hoho. It's a town in Ghana, and it's very close to my heart. I was partly raised in Ho, and so there's a bit of nostalgia in writing about Ho, and I think a lot of what I wrote about was kind of me describing things I had seen and heard, the sounds, the smells, the things people would say. I wanted to write about those things. And I think and personally, something else that matters is I think the importance of seeing oneself in books, seeing oneself in fiction. And it's not something that I've seen a lot of. And so I was really keen to write about Ho and this place in which I'd grown up, and in which I know people who still live there don't often get to see themselves in literature. And in the same way, Liberia is very important. I've had people say, is there some kind of conflict between Ghana and Liberia? No, not at all. This is just between Mona and Auntie, and they are not representative of diplomatic relations between Ghana and Liberia. We're actually very good friends. But I was born in Liberia. I lived there for many years. And so I also have a soft spot in my heart for Liberia. And as much as possible, I incorporated it into my work, my research, but also fiction. And that was why I wanted, I wrote Liberia into the story as well. But I mean, the selection of place is just very important to me. I very much want to document. And I think because there's just not enough documentation, certain places just don't get written about. And I'm keen to capture things as they were, but as they're evolving as well. And that continues to inform my writing, both fiction and nonfiction.
Speaking of evolution, I think that there's something that is particularly interesting in the ways in which we watch the female characters of this book evolve and come into their own, but it seems as though the male characters are just stuck. So the Richard that you meet at the beginning of the book is the Richard who you encounter at the end of the book. But for example, the Evelyn that we meet at the start is not the Evelyn who we meet towards the end of the book, and neither is the Afi. And so I wanted to know a little bit more about that. What informed the kind of evolution that we see a lot in your female characters that I think in many ways we don't see in your male characters? There's almost a stagnancy that you see, and you see it even in their relationships with each other, but also with the female characters.
Mm-hmm. No, that's an excellent question. And I think it's because When I was writing, this was a story about women. And for that reason, we get to see so much more. We get to see so much more of the women, and we get to see them evolving. And we're just very close to them. And the men, most of the men in the book are, they are in this position of, bit of a position of dominance. Because society has allowed it. And they just do not let go of this position of dominance. And I think, and that is why we just do not see this change. And it's partly because, and I mean, based on much of the work that I do, we just do not see men giving up this position of dominance, of privilege that they've had in whatever way they're able to manifest it. It just doesn't happen enough. And I think that is why I thought of these characters in this way. So not only is it because, I guess, the focus of the book is on the women and how they are able to resist, how they're able to push back, how they're able to speak up, but also because we're dealing with men that have a certain level of privilege and just do not want to let the privilege go. And I think the only way they would have evolved significantly, because I mean, there is a degree of evolution, but not to the extent like we see in a character like Afi. So Richard, for example, gets to a point where he comes to accept that this is like that. These are the choices that Afi is making. Togapayos gets to a point where he realizes that, look, Afi is just not going to take whatever he decides to throw at her. And he, of course, he throws his tantrums, he gets angry, but he just comes to accept that that is a reality. So they are changing, but not necessarily in a very dramatic fashion, and not in a way that is very progressive. Their change is more like resigning themselves to the fact that the women have become quite outspoken more than anything.
And I like that you say that piece, because I think one of the things that His Only Wife does beautifully is speak about like how women can create agencies in patriarchal societies. I think that we know that in patriarchal societies, women sort of need to carve out a way for them to exist, right? So you see Afe in the book sort of carve out a space for herself and be like, yeah, like these things that have worked for everyone else just don't work for me. And I hear what everyone is saying about, I'm supposed to do this and I'm supposed to do that, but I don't want to. I want to live my own life and I want to control my own things, right? And I like that you did that, because I think that we often, when we think about like African societies, we think about how women in these societies don't necessarily have agency. And in many ways, what you try to do with, I think most of the female characters is to show that you can carve out a space, right? I think about Muna, for instance, who is the, you know, this idea of this disrespectful woman, but she's not disrespectful. In truth, she's just saying, you can't come into my house as another woman and control what I'm going to do in my house. You know, you can't control me in the way that you've controlled other people. And you see Afe sort of take control of her life by saying, first of all, if this man is not going to come home, then why am I sitting at this apartment all by myself? I'm going to go to my mother's house. And, you know, people dissuade her from doing that. And she's like, no, like, you are not the people who are crying yourself to sleep. You're not the people who are cooking. And so I'm going to do this. So I wanted to speak about that, right? Just like how His Only Wife is a commentary about like women exercising agencies in oppressive societies.
Yes, very much so. I mean, from the very beginning, I knew that I wanted to write a book about a woman who comes into her own very gradually on a very rocky path, but that she eventually arrives at a place where she is much more, I was going to say empowered, but I don't really like that word. she's able to speak up. And she forces people to hear her when she speaks and to respect what she has to say. So I really wanted basically to write a book about this, or a book that that shows this. And I feel that, I think when we think about agency, we are often thinking about women doing things that are, I would say, very grand. And whether it's women as freedom fighters and, mm-hmm. and you know, women running for political office. And those things are just fantastic. And I love to see them. But I think that most women, and I'm thinking about whole growing up and the women that surrounded me, like people are doing tiny things, taking very tiny steps that even the people around them might not necessarily notice. But those tiny things that they do, whether it's disagreeing openly, it's saying, no, I don't want to do this, it's standing up for yourself, it's speaking up for someone else. I think those things are revolutionary, because at the end of the day, most of us are just not going to do anything that's grand that will be recognized on the national or on the international scale, and that is fine. But there is just so much, I think, power in just the daily, everyday things that women do. And I just, in my work, I really want to shine a light on it. I was raised by a grandmother who was a farmer and baked bread. And that was her life. But she is one of like the most forceful people that I ever met, and the amazing things that she was able to accomplish in her life. And I would write a book about her because she's my grandmother, but I don't think anyone else is going to say, well, we're going to write a book about her and we're going to build a statue in her honor. But she did so many things that I feel like were just groundbreaking. And so those are the kinds of stories that interest me, that I want to tell women's agency in ways that might not get a national recognition, but are still important to understand in society. And I also say, I just want to add this, that I think is important, is that when we think about politics, we have this notion of politics as this really thing, it's high up there. But I say that if you want to understand a society, you need to understand what happens within the home. And you need to understand these, like how much does society allow women to resist? And how much does society allow women to speak up and to, you know, make demands? And I think that if you really want to understand that politics that seems far away, you need to understand the level of interaction and agency that women possess at a very, I would say, within the home, within the community. That gives us a good understanding of a society.
I love the ways in which women's relationships were written in this book. So I think of the friendship between Mausi's mother and Afi's mother, mm-hmm. you know, and you think of the relationship between Afi and Mausi. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about why you felt it was important to write about women's friendship in this book and to shine a spotlight on it in the way that you did.
And this book is very much me remembering what I saw growing up. And I just saw that. And I continue to see that friendships, and sometimes a friend is a relative, or if a friend is someone who is, you know, far away, but still friendships, are just so very important in how women are able to navigate the world around them. And it's in big ways and it is in small ways. And in the book, friendship is almost like the engine that kind of turns the book and enables change to happen and propels the story. Whether it's friendship between Afi's mother and Mausi's mother, or between Afi and Mausi themselves, it is this thing that is driving the story forward. And I wanted to show this. And at the end of the day, all of the women in the book, because when we start off the book, we are made to think that Afi and Muna are on different sides. But by the time we get to the end of the book, we realize that, in fact, no, maybe Afi and Muna have been on the same side all along. And who knows, if given the chance, they might have been friends. And I really wanted to explore this, the complexities of female friendship. And going back to my theme of politics, I think it's political. I think it's powerful. And I think in literature, especially, female friendships might not be given the kind of attention that they deserve, at least not female friendships happening in Ghana, for example, might not be given the kind of attention that they deserve. And I wanted to contribute to changing that.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
I wanted to speak a little bit about Elakim's not showing up for his wedding and sort of that being a propeller of him not showing up in many instances, right? And just like how his character was really fascinating for me, because I felt on the one hand, he was just a really trashy person because he treated, in my mind at least, and to my eye, both these women really disrespectfully. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he also felt like I felt that he was torn in being doing the right thing and doing a thing that gives him great joy. You know, Elma and I were talking about, and I think a discussion we can have is about love, right? Because I think that to some degree that there was love between Afe and him.
No, it was convenient.
But I also, I think that the love between him and Muna was more, it felt a little bit more pure, right? And I wonder if the arranged marriage has something to do with, as Alma is saying, the convenience and the, how I would term some love and not like pure love.
Yeah, I think definitely the arranged marriage had an important role to play. It's, if you think about it, it's almost like having someone foisted on you and you are supposed to, someone you barely know, you're supposed to make a life of this person. And I think they did try. Afi definitely tried. Eli, I guess one could say he tried in his own way. But definitely there was something between Afi and Eli. And by the time we get to the end of the book, there's feeling on both sides, and maybe Afi is feeling more than he is feeling. But at the same time, what is between Eli and Muna is definitely different from what's between Eli and Afi. And I think it's because Muna was something that happened, or what he had with Muna was something that happened naturally. And he didn't have to almost make this decision to learn to accept this woman, to learn to love this woman. And so I think more than anything, it was theirs was kind of a natural relationship that happened. And Afi was almost like, you have to learn to love this person. And I guess he did to an extent. I'm not going to say if that's the best that he could have done, but he tried to an extent.
Guys, this trying to an extent is like, I feel in many ways that we see the ways in which patriarchy continuously oppresses women and limits their choices, and the ways in which it expands the world and the kind of choices that men can make throughout the book. And I think of the ways in which, for example, Elakim gets to navigate these two relationships almost seamlessly, and he's not held to account. So he has his wife that he claims he loves, Muna, kicked out of the house because Afi is now demanding that this must happen because she's had the son, etc., right? And his relationship with Muna doesn't end, even though he's really betrayed her in quite an obvious way. But he's also allowed to just dangle the carrots between these two women. Like, if you perform a little bit more, and that's what patriarchy does. If you perform respectability, if you perform good wifery a little bit better than your competition, then you are likely to be chosen. And I think you see that so much in the book. And so for me, I was really grappling with the idea of being chosen. What is what is the commentary that the book is making around being chosen for both of these women? Because in different ways, they both feel that they've been chosen.
And I feel like, Alma, I just want to reiterate what you're saying by reading, I think, possibly one of my favorite things that Evelyn, who's my favorite girl, says in the book, right? So she says, yes, that's true, but also that you should be happy, mostly, most importantly, that you should be happy, that you should have peace of mind, that marriage shouldn't be an ever, never-ending competition where you spend your life fighting to be seen and be chosen, that all the money in the world is not worth the pain, tears and sleepless nights, so you did good and you'll be fine. You're smart and you are not afraid of hard work, you'll be fine. And I think what you pick up on is, you know, where she says the marriage shouldn't be an ever-ending competition where you spend your life to be seen or chosen. Because I think a lot of it, as you say, Alma, is like, I feel really just like sitting with herself and be like, I've done all these things and yet this man doesn't want to choose me or want to see me. What more can I do? And so I think your question about like, what does it mean to be chosen is quite pertinent.
Yes, and I definitely wanted to say, I was trying to make a statement about being chosen and the how problematic it is. I think, so Afi is told that if you do these things, if you are, you look good and you cook and you clean and you're available sexually, and that is what is going to get you this grail, this holy grail of a man, that like the greatest prize. And that's the first problem, that this man has been set up as like the prize and what you should aspire to, and like it's the greatest thing that you can get in life. When she wants to go to school, her mother's like, sit at home and wait for him so that when he comes you can cater to him. And I really wanted to make that a problem and hopefully get readers to themselves to question this notion of the man as a prize. And Afi does reach a point when she's like, is he a prize? Or is he a husband? But I also wanted to show that even if you do everything, right, there's no guarantee that you're going to get what you want. And especially, so when Afi, by the time Afi has a son, she's gotten really confident. And she's like, I've done it all and I have the son. And that is going to get me the man. But I mean, how many stories are in there of women who do that and even more, and they still get cheated on, or, you know, they end up not winning this prize, which is the man. And I really wanted to really to unpack this whole idea about, you know, a man as something that almost an accomplishment, getting a man as an accomplishment. And I also really wanted to kind of this really get at this issue of competition between women for men, I don't even think necessarily women are competing so much as society makes it seem like women are competing. And this in this whole idea that if you have to outdo the other women. So when auntie comes and auntie is like, well, you know, he's this, you know, these Accra women, you have to be careful, otherwise they will snatch him. And it's like there's this constant competition. And what we need to be asking is why have we set the man up on the pedestal and we're asking women to compete for him? Why is that a thing that's happening? Why is it that despite everything that women bring to the table, society is not set up, or many societies are not set up that, you know, people should be competing for the women, and rather is the other way around? Or actually, maybe nobody should be competing for anyone. We should just all get along and live without all of that stress. But anyway, those were things that I wanted to really get at in the book.
I like that you say that, because I feel like there's another part where I was chuckling, where, you know, there's this idea in African societies where people are always concerned about what other people are going to say. So Afe makes this decision that she wants to get divorced, right? Because she no longer wants to fight to be chosen or to be seen. And she speaks to her mother and she says to her mother, look, my babes, I want out. And she says, Afe, you know that people will talk. And I love her reply to that, where she said, let them talk. Am I the first woman to ask for a divorce in this country? Women do it all the time and their lives don't come to an end. They continue to breathe and work, and some of them even manage to find love again. Why should I be any different? I'm still young. My business is going well. I will work and take care of myself and my son. Even if Eli decides not to give me one seed after today, we will be fine. So there's also this idea that I really love about, like, these women characters, particularly the three, Mona, Muna, Evelyn, and Afe, who sort of at some point are like, fuck the patriarchy, you know, because we're living in this world where we need to constantly do things for these men. And clearly this man is not going to choose me because he's already made up his mind. Why should I then suffer because of the decisions that he's made? And I really loved that in really subtle but powerful ways, these women were like, you know, giving the middle finger to patriarchy.
Yes, and I really wanted this. And when I began writing the book, I kind of thought I knew how it was going to go, but even the characters surprised me along the way as they became even more vocal than I am even. So I like that part about it. A lot of it, when I write, you know, in my mind, I have an idea of what the characters are going to do and what they're going to say. And then I start writing and then everything, like, they just take on a life of their own. And I love it when that happens. And for Afe was not, when I initially conceptualized this book came up with the story, Afe was not going to be waving the middle finger the extent to which she waved it near the end. But the character herself kind of made me create or divert the storyline to allow those things to happen. And I very much enjoyed writing it. And I think, and I guess that's another statement on my part. But what my hope when I was writing this book was that a lot of women in Ghana would read it. A lot of women from other African countries would read it. And that in its small, in a tiny way, I'm not thinking that people are going to read my book and the world will change, but that in a tiny way, it would kind of normalize rebellion. And will normalize, you know, people just saying, I've had it, I can't take it anymore, I'm out of here. So that's kind of partly my hope, or at least sparks conversation and gets people asking or thinking that maybe this is an alternative. And the point about society and what people think, I see it everywhere to an extent where people are concerned of what people think, but I think it's especially salient, you know, in Ghana and probably in many other African countries. But it actually partly comes out of my research. I work on issues of violence against women, and I remember doing interviews with women in Cote d'Ivoire, and these were survivors of sexual violence. And when they would talk about why they didn't want to report sexual violence to the police, the biggest issue was they were worried that people would know they had been raped. And after they had reported, some of them said, I regret it because now people know. And when I walk down the street, people are like, that's the woman that was raped. And people, even when my friends walk down the street, people are like, that is the friend of the woman who was raped. And so it just, I was very aware of how, I mean, from my own personal experience, but also from my own research about how much people were worried and people are worried and concerned about what people closest to them think. And I feel like it's, you have to, when you live in a society where, you know, if there's a fire and you call the fire department, they might not come, or they will come after your house is burnt down. So the people closest to you are extremely important. The people around you are important. And so I understand why, you know, people have these concerns, but it also ends up confining people and making it harder to do what is best for you. And I really wanted to write about this and hopefully get people thinking also about the extent to which the people around us are unknowingly or maybe knowingly controlling what we do.
Speaking of the people around us knowing and controlling what we do, I think that Auntie is an interesting example of the ways in which people around us seek control. Auntie is a benevolent dictator at best, you know. And there's a way in which she navigates the kind of choices that people around her feel that they can make because of her. And I wanted to delve a little bit more into the character of Auntie, because on the surface, Auntie is a good person. She is kind. She donates to the less fortunate. At any given time, there are a number of children that she's putting through school. But Auntie is also deeply problematic. And so I wanted to talk about why you wanted to write a character that is a woman as multifaceted as Auntie.
Yeah. I really wanted to write about characters that were complex. I think it's partly because that is just how people are. And like you can think of someone as extremely horrible, and then you meet someone who's like, well, that guy is just nice. And that is just the way the world is. And I really wanted to show this in the book. So Auntie is, you know, she is not, she's a very complex character. There is so much to her. And I like that she's straddling what we think of as masculine as well as the feminine. She plays both of those roles very well. She's aware of her power and she wields her power, but she knows how to wield her power in such a way that it inspires devotion. I was going to say love, but maybe not love from the people around her, love from her kids, yes, but more devotion and gratitude and loyalty from her neighbors and the people in the town who she's helping. And yeah, so that's the character of Auntie, and she causes us to question what we think of as motherly behavior. And I think that is just wonderful, because in reality, a lot of mothers are, maybe not a lot, but many mothers are demanding, and many mothers are saying that their kids should put obligation towards family first before their own whatever personal desires. And
for me, I think something that came up was the idea that there are characteristics in Auntie that make her very successful as a Black woman who's navigating the world by herself, which are also then undesirable in her familial relationships. And so when I think of how Auntie is so successful and has been able to be successful at the age that she's in, right? I think about what it must have taken for her to be, but also the ways in which the world has hardened her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because the fact that she is who she is because of her character. She's a tough woman. So Evelyn talks about how Auntie, many years before Auntie met her father, and try to get him to sell his produce at a lower price. And when he refused, he became auntie's enemy. So that is the woman, like that's the woman she is. She's tough. Unfortunately, the things that make it possible or made it possible for her to succeed are also the things that make her a person who is manipulative and is a bit of a bully, or maybe a lot of a bully, and you know, pushing people around and trying to get what she wants. And I think it's also a question about what does it take to succeed. And this is not to say every woman who succeeds in a very patriarchal, very patriarchal world in which we find ourselves is going to be an auntie. But sometimes the behavior that is, or the traits that are rewarded when it comes to business and commerce and politics tend not to necessarily be the traits that make people kind and nurturing. And therefore we might see some people who then end up succeeding, not everyone of course, but some people who succeed in these realms, then transfer some of these traits to their personal lives, like auntie, and then we see how that becomes a problem.
I think it's interesting though, because auntie as well allows us to think about motivation. I don't think auntie's motivation has always been good. I'm another person who, I loathe. You know, I want to get in a ring, man, and I just want to fight with this person because hi, man, toga payas. It just feels like that patriarchy emboldens people to do things that, like, it's just unacceptable. You know, this person doesn't help Afe and her mother when they are in distress, but at the moment where things are starting to look up for them, he inserts himself and inserts himself in like a very like African way, like, you know how like we often speak about how in African societies, and I think particularly, like, I don't know if it's the same for Ghana, Liberia, but we don't have, like, you know, sort of cousins, and in many instances we don't want to also say we have uncles, but it feels like your parents' siblings are also your parents, you know. And he uses that to his advantage. He does the most trashy things. And I wanted to know, what was the usefulness of a character like Toga Pius?
Yeah. Toga Pius was definitely, I think, one of the characters that molded Afi, because his negligence, his failure to perform his roles kind of put her in the position in which she found herself. And so Afi as a character is constantly growing. She meets people who are good and people who are not so good. But regardless of the kind of person she's meeting, they are forcing her to change as a person. And I think that is just the reality of how we grow and how we mature, that we have to be tested. And that's the role that Toga Pius plays in the book, that he's there to test Afi, and he's almost a stumbling block that she has to surmount in order to become the person that she's supposed to be. And Toga Pius is very much if frustration could be a person, it would be Toga Pius.
Honestly.
Yes, it's just, there's just so many versions of him. I think that it's a lot of the things that I detest about toxic masculinity, about the patriarchy, are kind of wrapped up neatly into this character of Toga Pius. And the funniest part about it is when my father read the book and said, "This is someone I know." And he was convinced that the character was based on someone he knows. And I said, "No, this is just," but then the fact that he thought he knew someone like Toga Pius in itself is troubling, that there are individuals out there who fit his his everything, his terrible characters, his characteristics. But and I told my father, no, it's actually not any one person. It's more ideas that have come together, and also I guess experiences and things I've heard over time about people's behavior, and all of that comes together into this one character that's very easy to loathe. But I enjoy Togga Pius because he made me laugh constantly. Like, so as I write some, partly it's kind of my, I guess it's what I do for fun. And so as I'm writing, it's almost like I'm also a reader, and I'm being entertained by the characters, and I'm shaking my head at their antics. So Togga Pius was actually a character that I very much enjoyed writing. I think one of my favorite scenes is when he shows up at Afi's house and he's like giving running commentary on what the food in the fridge and everything. And I absolutely love that part. He's a character that made me laugh a lot.
I'm glad that, you know, Togga Pius made you laugh, Peace, because Togga Pius, like, Letlokonolo, he enraged me, you know, like, Togga Pius really just represents the worst of what I think men have to offer. And so I think it's interesting that he made you laugh, but it made me then wonder about how your characters come to, you know, they are authors who've described characters coming and sitting with them and actually speaking to them. And I wonder what characters come to you and do. Like, I wonder how Togga Pius manifested.
I think often it starts off as an idea more than, like, before it actually gets to a stage where it's a character. Because even, like, the character of Afi, I just knew I wanted to write about a young woman who, you know, steps on some toes and does what she wants very gradually, but eventually gets to a stage where she's able to do what she wants in life. And it was years before that idea kind of became Afi. And so that is how I guess I come up with my characters. I usually start off with an idea, and then the ideas eventually evolve to a stage where I start adding meat and bones to them, and they eventually become people. So Togga Pius was, I think when I was writing, it was more like, you know, those things that annoy you about people, about like certain men that you meet, those characteristics that annoy you. That is what this character is going to be. And then it's out of the ideas that then eventually it's you end up with a character like Togga Pius, or that I end up with a character like him.
What I'm really interested in is, I really am interested in knowing. I felt that you shied away from explicitly writing about the sex, and I was really interested in that, like what the rationale was around sort of not writing too deeply about the sex.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up. I did write explicitly about the sex, and my editor was like, well, we should leave some of it to the imagination. So I then went back and decided that, okay, I would leave some things to the imagination. So there was definitely more sex. And the sex for me was a statement. I wanted to write about a woman who enjoyed sex. And mostly because I feel like, you know, women, I'm thinking very much about me growing up in Ghana. And where women are supposed to almost, and this is not everywhere in Ghana, maybe it's just my tiny experience, but women are supposed to behave like they don't even know what sex is. And sex is just supposed to be something that men enjoy. But the fact is that women enjoy sex. And I just wanted to write about a woman who enjoyed sex. And you can see that Afi Evelyn are different in that I feel enjoy sex, but she's being socialized to think that it's almost shameful to enjoy sex. So she's pretending like she doesn't. And Evelyn's like, I don't care. This is what I think about sex. This is when I had sex. And she talks about it openly. So I really wanted to write about just women having sex and enjoying it and not apologizing for it and not having to be ashamed of it or for it. that's what it is about the sex part. So yes, there was definitely more sex in the book.
I want more sex, please.
Have it.
What did you say, Alma?
Alma.
I mean, please. So I think that it's interesting that you know, Letlo Khonolo brought up sex, because I think that the attitude to sex displayed by Mausi's mother and Afi's mother actually tells us so much about their character and their relationship with their children. So Afi's mother wants to pretend that, you know, Elikem is the first man her daughter's been with, but Mausi's mother has a completely different attitude. And I think it was so interesting that she used sex to give us almost a glimpse into the very different characters that these two women have.
Yeah, because Afi's mother is just very conservative when it comes to sex, when it comes to almost everything. And she, and once again, this goes back to being concerned about what people think. She's very much a core part of the church. She's a very strong member of the church community. So she's always, of course, very concerned about what her fellow churchgoers are going to say about her. But then we see Mausi's mother is like, this is what I want. I don't care what my husband says. I will fight him if I have to. So Mausi's mother, yes, you would think of her as a woman who we find she doesn't have a formal education, similar to, you know, somebody like Evelyn. She's not employed in a formal sector, but still she's able to stand up for herself. She refuses to apologize for what she wants and for thinking and feeling the way that she feels. And yeah, so we then get to see the contrast between these two women, where Afi's mother is like, oh my goodness, what are people going to say? My daughter, you should only be seen with the man that you are going to eventually marry, which is like the most ridiculous thing. That the only man people should see you with is a man that you marry. How do you even go about doing all of that? And knowing that, well, this person, yes, I'm going to marry him so I can finally be seen in public with him. So yes, these two women in this way, they are very different, and their attitudes towards sex and relationships. Mausi's mother, you know, invites Mausi's boyfriend to their home for supper, whereas Afi's mother is like, I'm just going to pretend you've never seen a man before.
Can we talk about the ending of this book? Because No. I mean, peace. Is it possible? Do you have your book with you?
I do have my book with me, yes.
Can I ask you to read the sort of the page before the last? I don't know, we may have different versions, but the sentence starts with Eli comes by several times a week.
Okay, you want me to read that last paragraph?
Yes, until the end of the book.
Okay. Eli comes by several times a week. I haven't tried to stop him from seeing Selim. We've agreed that he can come by as often as he wants. He just has to tell me beforehand. I've also asked that he keep my son away from his woman. I heard from Evelyn that she has not moved back. She's not moved back into the house. But how can she, when Auntie has instructed Yaya to move in and take care of her brother, as though the household of servants is not enough, as though Ellie's a baby who can't take care of himself. He usually doesn't stay long when he comes here, and he's mostly in the bedroom of Selim or in the front yard. I try to stay away from the house when he gives me enough warning of his visits. I have to do this because my heart still beats wildly when I see him. I still wish that he had been at our wedding, that he, instead of Richard, had given me the ring and the Bible, that he had married me, that he'd wanted me to be his wife, his only wife.
I mean, woo, I felt it. Where she was.
I actually want to talk a little bit about like the frustration that Afi puts you through as a reader, and I'm sure that she puts you through as the writer, and the ways in which you actually force us as readers to become sympathetic to this character who's actually very frustrating.
Yes, Alma.
That's a great question. So Afi, I wanted, in writing Afi the way I wrote Afi, I wanted to kind of mirror the journey that a lot of us have as we come into our own. I think very few people, and it's not only about becoming a feminist or whatever eventual position we come to occupy, or we come to accept. I just think that as people, I think for most people, it's never a linear journey where you're young and then you say, look, this is what I believe. And, you know, you just come to this realization one day and then you live by this belief and this creed for the rest of your life. I think most people, that is just not how we come to find our voice. And I wanted to write that. I think progress for a lot of people, especially if you live in a society where you are being pushed and pulled in all directions. And when you live in a society where you're supposed to follow the rules, I think it's really hard to come to a stage where you are independent and you are able to, and I don't know if any of us becomes totally independent, I don't even think so. But to a place where you can stand up for yourself and you can say, this is what I believe and this is how I'm going to live my life. It's frustrating. And when I think about my own progress as a person, like I'm still growing and I have been around for a while. And so I just think that, and I've also seen that for a lot of people, that is how they grow and that is how they come into their own. And it's frustrating. And if you are someone who doesn't have power and you don't have resources, it's even harder to say, this is, you know, this is where I stand. And, you know, I arrived at this decision in a day and this is how I'm going to live my life. It rarely happens. And so Afi as a character is frustrating. It's two steps forward, it's one step back. And every time you think that finally she's arrived at a place where she's learned her lesson, nope, something else happens. And I loved writing her as a character. And I remember, so I would just be like, as I was writing, I would say, what are you doing? This is the wrong decision. Do not do this. This is not going to end well for you. Why are you doing this? And even I, the writer, was frustrated. And I wanted the reader to feel that frustration because I think that really illustrates the path that a lot of people take.
But I think also there was at least for me, the last bit of the book sat with me because I was like, Afi also wanted to, you know, like just the words, you know, she says, or at least you write, but she says, I still wish that he had been at our wedding, that he, instead of Richard, had given me the ring and the Bible, that he had married me, that he had wanted me to be his wife, his only wife. So there's still, even towards the end, like this, like sort of yearning to be chosen and to be seen, right? And so I felt a little heartbroken for her because I'm just like, you've been through so much and you still didn't get the man, right? Isn't that life? Isn't that life that we try to do all these things to please all these people, but sometimes things just don't work out? And how heartbreaking it is that, like, firstly, this man did not marry you, and now he still hasn't chosen you.
Yeah, I think you captured it well. It's life. And I've had conversations with people say, well, I wanted a happy ending. And I said, well, I think this is a happy ending, in that she is able to articulate what she wants. And I think we need to rethink what a happy ending is for women, or we need to be open to multiple happy endings, multiple paths, or multiple ideas of a happy ending. But that is life. The fact is that most people don't get what they want, and most people don't get the fairy tale ending. And most people have to learn to live with heartbreak. And so that's just what Afi's experience. And I think that's the experience of a lot of people.
I think that's actually such a heartbreaking way to think about it. But I think that for me, it was also just a story of becoming, right? So I think that Afi, in the beginning of the book, may not have been able to make such a brave decision, but we watch Afi evolve so much that even when she gets her happy ending in a different version, Afi is strong enough, but also self-confident enough to accept it. And for me, it is heartbreaking that she doesn't get the happy ending that's textbook. But I think that to watch a woman come into herself and to choose herself is an act of revolution. So for me, that ending was actually quite beautiful.
I very much agree with you. I very much agree with you. I think a big part of this book is, I think, I wanted her to put herself first. And the character wanted to put herself first. And when I was writing, I actually thought that Afi would end up with someone else. And in fact, that's the reason that the character Abraham exists in the book. Abraham, the man she meets at the
end. So I'm not going crazy, because I was like hoping, I was like, oh, Afi. Please, yes. Just like, you know what I was even hoping for? You know, there's a moment where it's their son's birthday and he is at the party.
Yes.
And there is a little encounter that they have outside of everything. I was like, please, just let them kiss. Just to, you know, one kiss. And then just like, you know, I feel I must just do something for her. I want to kiss this man and I'm going to kiss him. And it didn't happen. So I was just like, okay. You know, in my imagination, they kiss.
In your imagination, you know, and that is good enough, my friend. No, but I thought when I was writing, I thought she was going to end up with Abraham. But like I said, sometimes I start writing, the characters just do as they please. And I'm like, okay, well, Abraham is in the book now. And now Afi is like, nope, I'm going to stand on my own. I will not be rescued by a man. I will not run from the arms of one man to the arms of another. So I thought, what do I do with this character, Abraham? Do I take him out of the book completely? So there was a back and forth. I did make some changes to his character. But anyway, that's the only reason that he's in the book, because I had envisioned him, or I actually thought Afi was going to cheat on Ellie and eventually leave
what
Ellie.
He deserves. What
for
he deserves.
Abraham. What?
We're saying what he deserves.
Yeah, yes. But Afi eventually said, you know what, I'm not choosing any man. I mean, I think that's how the character evolved, that she decided not to choose any man. She just chose herself. And I like that. I like that. And I imagine that, of course, long after this book has ended, Afi moves on and finds what she wants in life. She finds the man who puts her first. Mm. But I also thought it was important to write a story in which a woman doesn't, like, happiness is not tied to being with a man. Mm. And getting yours. And that goes back to the conversation we had about a man, like a man as a prize. I really wanted to not kind of reinforce that notion in the ending of the book.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about two women in the book. I wonder about Muna and I wonder about Yaya. And mm-hmm. you know, for two different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yaya.
Hey?
Yeah. Mm.
So I wonder about Muna. I wonder about this other woman and this, you know, this myth of the bad woman, right?
Yes.
And how, like, because we can only know what Afi knows, right? And we can only experience what Afi experiences. We really don't get to know more about Mona. But was there ever somewhere in writing the book where she, you know, maybe there was a confrontation between them and, you know, they sat it down and thrashed out what really was happening? Because I'm really curious, because obviously she's possibly not this witch that we're told she is. She's not ugly because Afe says, this is the most beautiful woman I've seen. If she were gold, it would look like her, right? So we know that, like, she's stunning. And I just wonder, is there a version in the book, you know, where she, where they meet and where we sort of just get to know an inkling of her story? And I suppose similarly with Yaya, Yaya just seems like a little puppet for her mom's bidding. When does Yaya become her own person and sort of have some form of her own agency outside of like having to do the bidding of her mom?
Do you think, I mean, to counter that, Letofono, do you think that she's a puppet of her mother's, or do you think that she is her mother in training, firstly, but also that she benefits quite a lot from the toxic ways in which her mother interacts with people around her? So Yaya is able to forge space and is able to dictate space and dictate the way that things happen in her family because of the space that her mother allows her. So I don't know that she's necessarily a puppet, but I think that she also benefits quite deeply from her mother's toxic behavior.
Yeah, I think Yaya is a character. Yaya is, there's no feminist solidarity when it comes to Yaya. Yaya puts the patriarchy first. Yaya puts her class privilege above her gender solidarity. So I very much thought of Yaya and Evelyn, is it Evelyn describes Yaya as small auntie? And that is very much how I thought of Yaya, as you said, as auntie in training. And Yaya benefits from, and keep in mind that a lot of what is happening with auntie and with Yaya, it's about controlling the family's wealth. And it's about ensuring that they are vetting anyone who is being let in and ensuring that that person is not going to in any way encroach or take away from them. Yaya wants to be, and why did they not like Mona? They didn't like Mona because Mona is not giving them free access to Ellie's house, and to them, Ellie's house is their house. And so Yaya is all about protecting the wealth and ensuring that she can continue to enjoy it. And I very much saw her as kind of the person who would take over from her mother. And maybe Ellie, so Ellie of course thinks that when his mother is gone, he will have some peace, but who knows, maybe Yaya would be more of a troublemaker than her mother, although she will not get the same level of respect from her brothers that her mother gets. So that's Yaya as a character. I mean, the question about whether or not I imagine Afi and Mona meeting, yes, I had all these ideas of them and me being quite, or me loving the melodramatic. It's like, well, there will be a great fight and there'll be a brawl of some sort. There will be a screaming match. There will be whatever. I imagined Afi going to Mona's house and confronting her, or following Ellie one day when Ellie was, you know, putting his bags in the trunk to go and spend the weekend, Afi following him secretly and then confronting them. So I did think of all of these things happening, but ultimately I decided that this was Afi's story. And I decided that, look, regardless of who Mona is and how Mona became the person that she is and why she's with Ellie, none of that, I mean, that is important, yes, but none of that mattered for Afi's story. What mattered was what Mona did and how Afi experienced it, or what not even what Mona did, but what Afi thought Mona was doing. And We don't get to hear from Mona in the book, and this was on purpose, because I wanted us to feel the same kind of frustration that Afi felt with people constantly I mean, outright lying to her and concealing information from her. I wanted us I wanted the reader to experience this entire story the way Afi experienced it. So that is why we don't get to know Mona, because Afi also does not get to know Mona. And much of what the Ganyos are able to do is because Afi doesn't know Mona.
Peace, this has been such a wonderful conversation. I think it would be remiss of us not to ask you what your book being chosen as a Reese Witherspoon Book Club pick means and what it's done for you and your book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think the being chosen for the book club has just meant that I think people who might not have heard of the book heard of it, and people who maybe might not necessarily have picked it up suddenly, you know, they picked it up. And I mean, it was so that the book came out in September, but it wasn't announced as a book club pick until I think the 1st of October. And it was very interesting to see, because like just on Amazon, you can see Amazon rankings, and like the day before it was announced and the day after it was announced, how it shot up, and suddenly people were paying attention. I mean, it was the same book, but all of a sudden it was on the radar of so many more people. And the book club really does an excellent job of creating this community of encouraging reading, of supporting authors. And so, months after your book has been selected, there's still this engagement with the book club, and them regularly looking for ways in which they can continue to include you in their various activities. So I think I've just been really fortunate to be a part of this community, and I'm really happy for the attention that is brought to the book.
Thank you so much, Peace. I think that, you know, this has been a beautiful conversation, and I think we're always interested in stories that tell us more and encourage us to think widely about the interior lives of Black women, but also the ways in which we think about the Black woman in our lives, right? And I really think that this book did such a magnificent job of that. And so from the Chikinesis, we just really want to give you your flowers for writing in ways that brought Accra alive to Le Tlhokonolo and I. I mean, we've been saying that we actually want to go to Ghana.
I want to go today.
Now that we've read your book, we cannot wait to go to Ghana. But I think that's the beautiful thing about literature, is the ways in which it can bring the world to our doorsteps, right? And particularly so during a pandemic. So from the Cheeky Natives, we just wanted to give you your flowers and to thank you really for writing what is such a beautiful coming of age. But also just a coming of becoming of self that I think a lot of people will have questions for their own lives after reading this book.
Thank you. Thank you, Alma. Thank you, Le Tlhokonolo. It is like what you guys do is just, it's wonderful that you've created this platform, that you're engaging so deeply with the work. It's amazing. And in, as a first-time author, first of all, I write a book and I'm like, is someone going to publish it? And then if it gets published, and that in itself is a dream. And then that people all over the world, that people in South Africa reading my book, it's, I don't think I'm ever going to get used to that, to that idea, to this knowledge that there are people all over the world reading this book. So thank you all. Thank you for the love you've shown the book. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss it with you. Thank you for your brilliant questions that I've caused me to think even more deeply about some of what I've written. Thank you so much.
Oh, Cheeky Natives, as you've heard, we think his only wife is legit, right? And obviously, I mean, some of Aisha Haroon Atta says, I couldn't put down his only wife. Peace sentences are packed with muscle, beauty, and hilarity. And Cosmopolitan says, a fierce and funny study of modern womanhood within Ghanaian culture. So really, like, we encourage you to go out and get His Only Wife. We think that you'll definitely enjoy it. And I think it's a really wonderful pick for a book club because it's so engaging. So if you're part of a book club, His Only Wife is a book that you definitely have to have as a part of your books for this year. And Peace, we wish you all the very best. And Cheeky Natives, if you want to get a copy of His Only Wife, just pop us an email at info@cheekynatives.co.za and just ask us if we can order some copies for you through the Cheeky Merchant. And we're happy to do that because we think, you know, you deserve this book in your library. Again, Peace, from the Cheeky Natives, we are really, really happy that you could join us. And Dr. Slay, thank you for always holding it down with me. And for also being like, you have to read this book and we have to speak to Peace.
I mean, it's my pleasure. I'm just out here being Black Girl Magic. It's my absolute pleasure.
Until Thanks. Next time, Cheeky Natives, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.